Good morning, everybody. My name is Bobby Mesh, and I am an alcoholic. As Jim alluded to, this meeting has a very near and dear place in my heart. There's people I've met and have talked to in my recovery that have helped me immensely. So as soon as Jim reached out and asked, there was no question that I would make myself available to be able to speak at this meeting. I want to start with my own readings that I like and kind of a theme that I want to touch upon that has helped me in my sobriety journey. And the first one is the Herbert Spencer quote: "There's a principle which is a bar against all information, which is proof against all arguments, and which cannot fail to keep a man in everlasting ignorance. That principle is contempt prior to investigation." The Herbert Spencer quote from Spiritual Experience in the Big Book. And I find it apropos today, the October 20th daily reflection, as well as solace for confusion. Obviously, the dilemma of the wanderer from faith is that of profound confusion. He thinks himself lost to the comfort of any conviction at all. He cannot attain, in even a small degree, the assurance of the believer, the agnostic, or the atheist. He is the bewildered one. Some 12 steps and 12 traditions on page 28. And the story that goes along with it is the concept of God was one that I struggled with during my early years of sobriety. The images that came to me, conjured from my past, were heavy with fear, rejection, and condemnation. Then I heard my friend Ed's image of a higher power. As a boy, he had been allowed a litter of puppies, provided that he assumed responsibility for their care. Each morning, he would find the unavoidable byproducts of the puppies on the kitchen floor. Despite frustration, Ed said he couldn't get angry because that's the nature of puppies. Ed felt that God viewed our defects and shortcomings with a similar understanding and warmth. I've often found solace from my personal confusion in Ed's calming concept of God. And that I felt was great because last night I had to deal with the nature of puppies, I guess, is a family member of mine called me. She witnessed her neighbor's dog being hit by a car. And of course, she runs over. She's 20 years older than me, so she's in her 50s. She runs over trying to help the dog, and the dog, in its own agony, ends up biting her and cutting her hand fairly badly. And with her own trauma, she also has a heart condition. Her blood pressure spiked, and eventually there was an ambulance, and she was taken to the hospital. So right around my bedtime of 9:30 at night, I get a call about, hey, like, Colleen's going to the hospital. And can you pick her up when she's done? And the first inkling is shit. Like, I don't want to do that. I knew she was okay. It was precautionary. But then very quickly that's removed that, yeah, of course I'll be there. That's not a problem. I'll stay up if I have to. And I ended up having to pick her up at 1 a.m. because that's what I do now. When people ask for something, if it's within my power to be able to give them and help them, then I do that. The helping part being very important to me and a way that I kind of live my life. And that's where I'm at now, is where family members and people can call on me to be there, to show up. Something that in my early drinking days, I wasn't able to do. I wasn't able to do that up to even 5 years ago, even able to do that in my early 30s. Because my story, it's not unique. I'm not a special person. I'm just like anybody else in this program where drinking had become came to a point in their life where it was destruction. And I do like the book's description on page 30 about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Because time and time again, my drinking led me to that every time. And I wish I had some great story to start off with about my early days of drinking. My first drink, when I remember this, and I was sitting by the fire and somebody gave me this, and I don't have any of that. My sponsor does. He's got a great story that he tells about his first drink, and I don't have that because I don't remember it. I just know that the blur of, I don't know, age 10, 11, 12, 9, I don't really remember, was when I started drinking. It was always to get messed up. There was no drinking like a gentleman. That was never something that I did. And that followed me for quite a long time up until my last drink. Because, like my first drink, my last drink which is 12/29/19. I don't remember either because I drank so much where I woke up in the hospital and had to be taken by an ambulance and woke up, and that was not the first time that it happened. And that was really the point where I knew I had a problem. And it was when I started to use a solution given to me freely by the members of Alcoholics Anonymous that I could look back at my past. My past, which included starting young, like most people. By 15, 16 years old, I was in high school. I was selling marijuana, some cocaine, drinking all the time, partying, but I was still doing okay in school. It was always okay. This is when I was young, this is how I made it okay, is my parents were never on my ass about my partying or the things that I did as long as I kept good grades in school. So I always was a good student. I got those things done. But when it came to hanging out with my buddies, like that's what we did. We went and got messed up. We went and started seeing music. And by the age of 18, I got really into the jam band scene. What would be in the early days would be like the Grateful Dead, and then the 90s was Phish. And there's other bands, like I followed a band called the Disco Biscuits, which was a lot of fun. And it was, to put it in simple terms, the band played music that was could only be equated to raving. So when you talk about raving, there's a lot of alcohol and there's a lot of other drugs involved as well. And drugs are certainly a part of my story, but it was always alcohol that that got me. Since I'm in an AA meeting, I'll stick to talking about alcohol, although I'm probably an addict too. And I guess if I ever went to an NA meeting, I would probably say I'm an addict and probably an alcoholic. So I had some really awesome times. They were a lot of fun. When you're young and you start off with your group of friends, because that's how you are. You roll as a pack, you're 18, 19, 20, 21, you're having the greatest of times. I was always the one that was willing to put myself out there in order to help others. I was always kind of a helper, but I always really and almost subconsciously would help people to the point of setting myself on fire to keep them warm. And that is something that I didn't learn till later in life through the help in AA that is detrimental to me, is doing things that are so helpful where it's detrimental to yourself when in turn it's actually not helpful. That's the paradox of it, because you're hurting yourself. And that's all I did, is I learned how to hurt myself. Anything that went wrong in my life in an early age, I would bury it deep with alcohol, especially alcohol. And my first DWI at 21, I had just turned 21 in June of 09, and by August I was at a Phish show. And after the show, I was the guy that was going to drive home. I was the responsible one. All my friends were partying off doing things, and I'm at the car waiting for them while they're doing whatever. And I meet a guy next to us, and he brings out this great body, the Blue Label Johnny Walker. Like, he whips out that, the really good stuff. And I was like, oh man, like I'll take a couple fingers of that. 'Cause that's like, I'll be all right. I can have a drink and then drive. And so me and this guy are shooting the shit, talking, and I have, two, three, four, six fingers of Johnny Walker Blue Label with this guy as we're shooting the shit. And then I get in the car, it's like, all right, everybody, it's time to go. I'm gonna drive home. And everybody's all messed up, and somebody's messing with me as I'm driving home. And I get pulled over because I'm speeding, leaving Darien Lake here in the Buffalo area where those concerts are held. And I get arrested pretty swiftly. The odd part is everyone else in the car was really messed up on not only alcohol, but psychedelic drugs as well. And what they ended up doing was taking me to jail. That one cop drove the car to a church, left it the keys with somebody else, and then they all took me to jail. And the cops, I think, were nice enough to me that they didn't make me blow the actual official breathalyzer, because I know this is probably preaching to the choir here, but the breathalyzer you get on the side of the road is not admissible. It's not until you get the one that you're actually at the holding center or the jail, or is the one that is admissible in court. So these cops talked to me, and I've always been quite loquacious and always been an outgoing soul, which is okay. But when you're arrested for driving while intoxicated, talking ad nauseum to the police is probably not the best thing to do. And I found that out because in the police report was part of the conversations that we had with the cops, including must have been the Johnny Walker. And I remember seeing the police report, and my dad laughed at that as well, and I laughed. But the thing about the police officers is they didn't make me blow into that breathalyzer for nearly 6 or 7 hours after being arrested. So I sat from midnight, 1 o'clock till the sun was up, and then they finally made me blow before I was able to leave. And I still blew 0.17. So biochemically, your body breaks down about 0.02. So it's safe to say that I was well above triple the legal limit when I was pulled over. And you would think that I would have learned a lesson, but I didn't. Because not to go ad nauseum about how it was, but another DWI happened. Again, I was out with a girl. I was living in Syracuse at the time. And I was like, no. I'll drive you home after we're on a date. We're out drinking. And she was like, no, I'm gonna take a cab. And me, I was insisting on being that nice guy, being that person that's helpful. Got pulled over again and arrested. 0.10. And when you get another driving while intoxicated offense within a couple of years of a first one, even if it was reduced to a DWAI, they pretty much throw the book at you. And so then I'm standing in front of a judge. There's no leniency this time. There's no cops helping me out this time. The lawyer said there's nothing they're going to do. They're charging you with DWI, a misdemeanor DWI, and they're going to put you on probation for 3 years. And me at that point, I'm like, me? I'm not that guy. I don't get in trouble. Like, I don't get arrested. I'm not a criminal. Well, point of fact, Bob, you are a criminal because you just were charged and sentenced to 3 years of probation for driving while intoxicated. So those things that you think about yourself are actually not true. And so I was on probation and I was the biggest asshole on probation. I was a slick talker. My probation officer, after a few months, realized that I was a guy in school. She had bigger fish to fry probably when she was in Syracuse. Never got one drug test, not one breathalyzer. And I took advantage of that. And I would still drink on the weekends. And by the end of it, I was seeing her once a month as opposed to any other time. She never came and saw me. And by 24 months, I was off for good behavior and doing well. But I wasn't really doing that well. And that kind of behavior continued up until other things had happened. So now we have the legal, more legal stuff because I was arrested multiple more times for drinking stuff. But well, just the one I'll say is I was at another fish show. And I decided it was a good idea to drink a lot and then eat psychedelics and then buy cocaine and then be all fucked up at a concert trying to do said cocaine out in the open. And a drunker than a skunk, high, and a security guard came and got me and I was arrested again and taken to the holding center at SPAC, Saratoga Performing Arts Center. And the thing was, is when they took that initial bag of cocaine and I was drunk and when I finally started to come to, I was handcuffed with five other gentlemen inside of the jail cell and they had yet to search me. So I realized that I still had in my sock another party favor. So I decided it was a good idea to get rid of the evidence and handcuffed to a jail cell with five other gentlemen. Me and the other four guys decided, me and the other gentleman decided to get rid of that evidence in a jail cell. And I can't believe that I actually ever did that I ended up getting rid of the evidence by physically doing the drugs with other guys handcuffed to a jail cell. And I again, these are things that you think about as the daily reflection called about is the condemnation, the rejection, the things of your past and the fear of all that. And I didn't want to feel that stuff for a while. I never wanted to really put my best foot forward anything. I was kind of somebody that always half-assed it, but I was smart enough to kind of get by. And after that arrest, I still didn't learn my lesson. I really hadn't. But what really started me down a path of getting better, at least starting to go to AA, was when the physical things started to happen. I said something I shouldn't too drunk as a skunk to somebody and he knocked me out. And I broke my leg when I fell. I was over 300 pounds at that point. I fell and broke my leg, and he broke my jaw, and I was in the hospital again. I have a plate and 9 screws in my leg because of that. But it was that point that I needed to start to go to AA, and I was, I don't know if it's classic. I don't know if this is just all part of the process, the phases or whatever it is there isn't a complete leveling of the pride and a complete admittance of shortcomings, as the book calls it, when you start to go, because you still think me, not me, like I'm a trained chemist. I'm a smart guy. Like I'm not one of these things, not me, but I'll go to this for a while because I'll see if I can get right. But it didn't work. I was the guy that went once a week. I remember telling people like, oh, I go to AA. I go once a week on a Monday, and I don't have a sponsor. I don't do any of the things that they tell you to do, but I go to AA. So that makes me a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I relapsed again outside, and I ended up passing out and being taken to the hospital, because at this point I was in graduate school, and after 9 months of sobriety I relapsed, and woke up in the hospital again after trying to pee again next to a bar in the winter time with my pants down to my legs. I got taken to the hospital because I passed out in a snowbank. So the thing about that is then I realized, like, even after months of sobriety, like, I don't drink like a gentleman. When I start drinking again, when the liquor goes in, when the alcohol goes in, the phenomenon of craving takes over, and I go right back to drinking how I used to drink. And with some sobriety, your body no longer has the tolerance it did, so that's what happens. And I drink like a fish, and I do stupid things, and I'm not the person that I want to be. I'm not living in accordance with what my higher power would probably have me be. And I would love to say that that was the time I stopped, but then I had almost a year, and the same thing happened. I went to a couple AA meetings, and then I stopped, and then you get dry, and I ended up in New York City going to see the Disco Biscuits, that concert, the same people, the same things. I ended up at a show with not anybody, any sort of support, and I was with people, and I started drinking, and I was like, oh, I got this. I can have a few. And I drank to the point that I was a vile, disgusting form of myself, the Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, as the book likes to call it. I relate so highly to that in the book. And I woke up in the hospital again for drinking. So I decided that, I don't know, something had to give. And it was in the end of 2019, and then COVID came around. And I would love to say that that moment is really was the moment that got me, but there's many, many moments. And it was then COVID happened, and I stayed sober because I happened to get a girlfriend at that time. And I do truly believe at this point, this person that came into my life then, who was wonderful. She's 10 years younger than me. I was in graduate school, and she really cared about me and helped me go to meetings. And I started to get it a little bit more. I went more than just once a week. I went to more meetings. But as I graduated that following year, I got more focused on my career and where I was going to be. We ended up separating because I decided to take a job in Oregon at a company that I did most of my graduate work with, in chemistry. I do process chemistry. I'm a synthetic chemist. And it was out there that I moved, and I was alone. Once again, I moved all the way across the country. I was alone. I took this job, and when you're young, I guess, and naive, or don't really know things about the professional world, I held on to the thing that I was comfortable with. This job that I had, these people that I worked for, and I moved all the way out there, taking a position where it took me 8 months of being there, realizing that this was me, but I didn't know what to do. And I was so afraid and so scared about what my life was going to look like that I started thinking about drinking again, because at that time I wasn't practicing a program of AA. I didn't even have, if I'm honest with myself about it, I didn't have an inkling of what that actually looked like or meant. And it was in August, July, August of 2021 that I realized, sitting in my apartment all alone, that my brain started telling me that there's a bar 400 yards up the road. Like, you can just walk there. You don't need to drive. Like, you can just walk there and then come back. And it was in that exact moment, for whatever reason, God, whatever you want to call it. I went, holy shit, it's all happening again. How many times is this cycle going to happen where I quit and then I convince myself that I'm going to be able to go drink like a gentleman, that I'm going to be able to go and handle it, that all of my emotional baggage and issues are not going to come spewing out or try to be relieved by this alcohol that I drink, where it never happens. It ends in pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. So oddly enough, I went on the phone, and that's when the grace of God brought me to an AA meeting, because 400 yards down the road was a bar, but 1,000 yards down the road was an AA meeting that I could walk to. So yeah, I had to walk past the bar. I had to go a little bit farther, but I went to an AA meeting and I found these gentlemen in Oregon. And then that's when getting a sponsor happened. And I reached out to a friend back here who was in the program as well. And she said, well, I got somebody you can talk to. And I started talking to this gentleman named Mark, and Mark is still my sponsor to this day, 3 years later. And that was really the start of me digging through and actually working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That was the first time I sat down and did a four step. The first time I started to do a nightly review. I worked the steps with somebody, and what's funny about Oregon is that's when I first heard a talk by Tom Brady Jr. I don't know if it's a classic talk, but it is, and it's a talk about emotional sobriety. And in that talk, it's one that I go to frequently, understanding that is one of the main pillars of this program, is that the alcohol and the extracurricular activities and whatever things that you go to try to numb whatever emotional turbulence you're in, the negative emotion that comes with life, that the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous can help you. Because I went through the steps. I worked with a sponsor. I talked about the things that were most fearful to me. And I felt good in my drinking, in my desire to not drink. I'm sorry. And the thing about that is, when you get an early sobriety and you go through these steps and you're feeling good, you've laid it out, and now you've told somebody else step five. You've asked God for some help. You've asked God to take away these things that are holding you back, and you admit your wrongdoings, and you pray and you meditate and you try to be close with yourself. Man, you get into that phase of sobriety, you get a year sober, and you're so goddamn spiritual, man. Like, you are so spiritual. Can't you see how spiritual I am? Can't you see how good I'm doing? And you get involved with people, and that's what happened. When I moved back, I still had the people here in Buffalo that I still do care for, but I got back around them. I was working AA. I was so spiritual, and I was trying to take this message to the people that I know, trying to live this way, like as it says in the book, like the family, the people will come around to seeing your way of living. And I got involved with a girl. And that was a point that I didn't realize there are other things you can get addicted to. And there are subconscious things that you get attached to. And that whole idea of setting yourself on fire to keep others warm raised its ugly head again. And I got involved with somebody because I'm so spiritual, and this woman over here, she's pretty, that's fun, it's a good time, but she uses drugs regularly and drinks like a fish. But it's gonna be okay because I'm so spiritual. That's really good for me. It's gonna work. Like, I'm gonna figure it out, because things like sex, things like codependency, you don't really know about them. And what happens is the crash from that relationship was something that I did not know was even possible from a mental and spiritual standpoint. When that ended, by shocker, somebody who lives an unstable lifestyle, you know, manipulated me. I shouldn't say that I was so convinced that I could fix this person, not help them, fix them, that I just completely had the blinders on. And what happened was the blinders came off. There was infidelity, and I was shocked by this. I was traumatized by the fact that that could happen. I went to a place that I didn't even know was possible. Real mourning, real self-doubt, real, 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 real dark places. Suicidal ideation. People talk about that, like being suicidal, but actually being there and having and going through that, it was the hands down most terrifying thing that I ever had. It was It was worse than waking up in any hospital, any jail cell, anything like that. It was having to realize, as Bill Wilson wrote in his letter, in The New Frontier, about the dependency demand cycle, this idea of having to look outside yourself for this validation, these things that don't actually matter, that I'm so blinded that I'm looking for things and other people and other situations that I still, being so spiritual, had this gigantic hole in my heart. And that heart, as I've come to realize, is a God-shaped hole. Asking intently what it is that I can do. And it was there in that darkness that I really, really, for real, I think, started to understand that I am powerless over much more than just the alcohol. And that if I come to believe that, like, there's a God that wants to help me, and the foxhole prayers come out, that's when you're in a bad spot. The foxhole prayers start coming out. I'm like, I remember being like, whatever I have to do to get through this, I'll do it. And the thing that God does, but put me through that for almost a year. And it was gentlemen in this program that were there for me during that. People I've talked to, people that helped me, people that were there to listen about nonsense. I look back on it now, it's so easy now when you can actually work through something. Look back on it, it's like such nonsense. And it's like, what did you think was gonna happen, dummy? And it's okay, I can laugh at that now. And I can be all right, but there's still remnants of that because there's attachment. But there's no, you can attach to good things. And the people in this program, that's what my higher power and the conception of God is like. Listen to these people, the people that have come before you, because that idea that, like, you ain't that goddamn spiritual and your head's gonna pop out of your ass in 5 years is a real thing. The more you know, as you actually go and the layers of the onion get peeled and you trudge through this stuff, you laugh, and the things that you thought were so important, those that dependency demand on outside institutions and outside people, on things that don't matter, start to become so minuscule when you try to actually rely on the bigger thing. And this idea started to mollify my life. I started to live my life by the principles, the design for living that is in that book, earnestly trying to apply that to my everyday life. And the thing that mollified in my head was that this is a giving life. That I don't have to set myself on fire to be a helpful person to another human being, to be someone's friend, to listen, because I can't fix anyone. That if I rely on my ability to be helpful and to be the guy, to be a nice guy, if you will, not necessarily just kind, but nice, like, can't you see the how nice I am to you? That means that if I'm good to you, you're going to be good to me. And I need that. I need that on a level. But working through and realizing that there's nothing I can do, the powerlessness over my alcoholism can be applied also to my powerlessness over what goes on in this world. Not that I can't take a stand for myself and have morals and have principles and have convictions and to give and to take, and instead of a dysfunctional relationship, have what the psychological literature would call an interdependent relationship with others, where we rely on one another and then trust is built. And when I rely on the men of AA and the women of AA, that to me is me building that cornerstone, as the book calls it, with God. Understanding that these people, as much as I don't like what they have to say, and it's great that Pete Evenhouse got mentioned in this meeting already. And PE, in those dark days I talk about outside of the Knox Group meeting, he had to tell me how it was, look at me directly in the eye and saying, you can't be around that. The truth. The truth. Hiding it from myself, the blinders are on. But when they come off, and sometimes it's terrifying, and you're wiped clean, whatever that might be, the ego, you start to see yourself exactly as you are. And you can build slowly and surely in that brick by brick. I love that, actually. The brick by brick, you could say, but I come to realize I like a better analogy. It's not brick by brick. Sometimes putting yourself back together in this program and staying the course and staying true, understanding that the men and women in this program actually do have your best interest in mind, is that it's each grain of sand that has to go into that brick in order to put that brick in place. It is arduous, it is hard, it is difficult. And it takes years and it takes a long time. The old timers here, oh man, I remember being and Bob from the Lakeview meeting, listening to him, looking at me with that shit-eating grin that those old timers get when you're in a terrible spot. And they look at you and they put their hand on their back and they're there for you and they say to you, pain is the pathway to peace. God, I do not want to hear that in the middle of it all. Pain is the pathway to peace. And you stick with it. And you kind of sit with yourself and you do that really, really deep intellectual and spiritual work when you go, something has got to give. I can think all I want that I'm this great guy, that I'm awesome, but if my actions don't resemble that, then I'm just full of shit. Completely. And that is a leveling of the pride and admittance of shortcomings that helped me to at least design through the work of Alcoholics Anonymous a way of living that I could be proud of. Because another old timer in AA said to me, I thought we're supposed to leave pride away. He said to me, he's like, take pride in your sobriety. Take pride in that. That's real pride, not false pride, not look at me, look at the stuff I got, look at this. But I take pride in being able to sit down with another man who's going through a tough time, whether that's at a treatment center or a phone call or somewhere from another country, because that's happened to me now too. And just having that moment where I don't know what to do. Not that I have all the answers, but I remember exactly what that was like. Exactly. And that's profound and it's powerful. And it's something that I cannot put even words to. That moment when you're working with somebody and you see something, or somebody comes to you and they have this respect for you that you, because you now have this respect for yourself. These old ideas that you had, you start putting the new ones. And if you put new ideas and your actions in your head over enough, a long enough period of time, these things start to grow and you start to believe them. That self-doubt, that self-hate, the most malignant of all character defects, self-hate, will start to not be extinguished, not ever be gone, because it's not, because that's what makes us human. But you can start to look at things that you've done and be proud of yourself. And self-love is a very important concept to me personally, so that if I respect myself and don't set myself on fire for others, but actually do what needs to be done in any moment, because sometimes it's telling somebody the truth, because you can't fix what they have or fix what they need to do, but you can trudge with them. You can reach out your hand, as it calls it, and say, like, I have a way. I know people. I don't have all the answers. When I work with guys, if I don't have all the answers, I bring other guys in that have the answers that can help to get somebody to where they need to go. Because at the end of the day, it's a very good thing to know, to believe, to start to internalize that I am not alone. That the other men that come in here, broken, battered, can start to internalize that they are not alone, that it is possible to dig yourself out of a mental place, a physical place, a spiritual place. And that spiritual place that's helped me again is this idea that this is a giving life. And to talk about God wanting me to be happy, joyous, and free. And I need to follow and be spiritual at all times in my life. And God, I wish I could be like that all the time. But unfortunately, as Marcus Aurelius says, I'm only a man. And I come with all the same things that a human being, a man, comes with. I'm fallible. I can make the wrong decision sometimes. I can get angry. I can feel emotion. But we have a step for that. Because in the book, it doesn't say you're going to go through these steps and you're going to walk around and you are going to start turning water into wine. It says when these arise, those negative emotions to talk about, fear, dishonesty, when these arise, when those inclinations, when things arise, you can catch them and you can start to ask for them to be removed. And what do I do? What is the next right thing that I do? And it really, for me, is working with others that has profoundly changed my life in a way that is helpful, is not fixing. I do not go into anybody and tell them either you're gonna do it my way, or I'm not gonna work with you. It's always the AA way. And that way, when I work with others, I bring my advisors in, my sponsor sponsor other people in about how should we approach somebody. It's a committee thing for me personally. That's how I work, because I don't have all the answers. And if I seek God, I have to seek God in others. I have to, because that's for me where I found in this program outside is I level my pride and look for the answers that come through God with skin, which is all of you. And having worked with people and continuing to work, because I have my home group, but every single day there's multiple group chats I'm in that we send each other things. And it's only through that that I'm able to be here in a right mindset and better. Those dark days don't haunt me like they used to. Do things come up? Sure, but I'm not sitting in it anymore. And having this be a giving life means sometimes I have to not give, if that makes any sense. That if somebody's, you got to let somebody fall flat on their face sometimes. You got to let somebody go. And I can't get so emotionally attached to sponsees who come in and then they go away and they go out and drink again, because that's what we do, because that's what I did. It's not me that's going to have the power over them. I can love them, I can detach from them and understand that when they come back, I'm right here. And it bothers me sometimes that I want to tell somebody, like, if you go out, just come back, just keep coming back, show up. Just showing up is half of the thing. And it took me years to show up here and actually start to get it and to have some semblance of an actual sobriety. I mean, shoot, I'll be 5 years without a drink, and my sobriety date, I do 3 years because that's everything else, but 3 years. And it's like my joke to myself is, oh man, I think maybe I'm finally through like step two, like actually coming to believe and internalize that, because you start to see the things that can happen if you stay the course, the promises, if you will. And that's how I live my life. Jim texts, you know, hey, you want to speak? Is there anything you do? Like, of course, 100% anything you can do. You know, one of my friends in here, he texted me a month ago about the Buffalo convention. Be here. He just texted me. He's like, oh, by the way, I signed you up to be a greeter at the convention on Friday. It's 5 o'clock. I was like, all right, I guess that's where I'll be at 5 o'clock on Friday the 18th. So thanks, Pat. I know you're here. Appreciate that. It was a good time. It was fun. But the reason I went through the steps and the reason I continue to go through the steps, I'm going through the gamma is so I can have the blinders on, that I don't get so in myself that I think that I can rule the world. That's because that's true, man. The ego will come up and snatch. That's it is so cunning and baffling. Like it is wild. And this whole idea of the giving life is in learning that that is really where it is that juice of this program is in helping others and being there on not just AA, but anything in general, anything at work, being kind, somebody's having a bad day, listening to them. And that's why the steps are in order. And then you end up at the place where it's having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We try to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles on all our affairs. All our affairs. It's hard. So it's hard because sometimes somebody does something and you can tell that they're just being who they are. But does it not make me a better? Does it not make me more spiritual to not nitpick and not take someone's inventory, not put them down, to not cut them down at their legs and stand on them and tell everybody that I'm tall because I did that? And that's why sometimes the best thing to do is just not say anything at all. That's a tough one for a guy like me, because I am a fucking chatty guy. Pardon my language, but I am a things come up, my brain works, and I want to say them, but I'm learning to be more succinct, learning that I still have a lot of growing to do, that the spiritual life is not a theory, that you have to live it. And it takes time. Time takes time. And through pain, there will be peace. That's true. That's been my experience. And the things I'll end with, so we have 5 minutes left, is three, that not one thing I can take as being my own. There's not one original idea that I touched on in here. Not one at all. I just try to carry the message. That's all I can do is when Jim asks is to do that. And that helps me. It makes me, why do I feel so good when I do that? When I sit with another person, I mean, there's a feeling, no drug, no alcohol, no nothing like that can ever get there. Not even an orgasm. I don't think I really get to that point, to be honest. Orgasm is heavenly, but not when it's being helpful and you see somebody change over even a short period of time to really want to devote themselves, and you can be there and earnestly. There's just nothing like it. So again, not one of these ideas is original, and I appreciate you guys for having me speak. I really do. Thank you. It's a good way to start the Sunday. And as Tom Brady ended his talks with, I've kind of adopted this from him, because he used to end his letters with this. And I really kind of adopted this as well, as be gentle with yourself, even in the darkness, and don't pick up the bat. And of course, I know this is going to be controversial given the nature of this meeting, but God bless the Buffalo Bills. Thank you, guys.